It's the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris, filling in for Martin and Randy today. Thank you so much for listening. Coming up later on in this hour, what you think you know about illegal immigration is probably wrong, says a professor who's been studying population research for decades. And what you're hearing from presidential candidates is also almost 100% wrong. You'll get details on that and some actual facts and numbers a little bit later on in this hour. Also, I've got to talk a little bit about the clerk down in Kentucky who is going to get visits from a couple of presidential candidates today. And if I have time, I've got to do a little rant about how our bridges are falling down here in Missouri because we just don't put any money into fixing them. But to start off this hour, Barry Schwartz is a professor of psychology at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania and author of a new book called Why We Work, and I've invited him to join me here today to talk about it. Hi, Barry. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. I would think that the three-word title, Why We Work, has a three-word answer, to make money. But according to your book, that's not the answer, is it?
Well, it's part of the answer. The point of my book is to suggest that we have regarded it as the whole answer. And by we, I don't mean people who do the work, mostly. I mean people who manage people who do the work. If you ask most people what they want out of work, of course they want to get paid, but they want other things. They want to feel in charge of their work. They want to feel a certain amount of discretion in what they do. They want to feel like they can develop and grow with the job. And they want to feel like what they do is meaningful, that it makes a difference to somebody. And of course they want a paycheck, but they want those other things too. But managers, companies have largely assumed that it's all about the paycheck, and as long as you get that right, nothing else matters.
Are you saying that more money does not necessarily equal better work?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
Because people care about other things. You spend half your waking life doing something, and who wants to spend half their lives in a place they don't want to be doing a job they don't want to do?
So is this a modern problem, or has it always been this way? Have we changed the way we're treated or management treats us?
I think it's not. It has pretty much always been this way, and people in the field of management will periodically articulate the views that are in my book, that people care about more than this, and if you actually create an enlightened workplace, not only will you make the workers happier, but you'll also get more productive work and you'll make bigger profits. So this goes in and out of fashion, at least among management types. It rarely seems to have penetrate into the structure of the work organizations themselves. There's a kind of command and control. Don't trust the worker. Make sure you're looking over the worker's shoulders. Give them a script to follow. Make it as mindless as possible attitude. Now, not every workplace is like that, but many of them are, and really none of them should be.
I'm going to ask you to tell a couple of stories that you have in the book because I think they're so illustrative of what you're trying to say here. And I would like you to start, if you would, with the story of the CEO of the carpet company who wanted to inspire his employees to work harder and do more.
Right. Well, he didn't actually want to inspire his employees. He was very successful, had lots of money, and he had this epiphany one day that it wasn't going to do much good to leave his grandchildren piles of money if they were going to be inhabiting a world that was uninhabitable. And his factories left a huge environmental footprint. So he made this commitment to a 20-year plan to reduce the environmental footprint to zero. That was his mission. That was how he was going to finish his career. He knew that it was going to cost the company money. He didn't care. He had all the money he needed. And so they launched this project to change the way they did things. They're about three-quarters of the way to their goal at this point. And the astonishing thing is that the profits went up, not down. And their understanding of how that happened is that this mission to save the Earth so inspired the workforce that they worked harder and smarter than they ever had before. They came to work totally energized, not to produce another 1,000 yards of carpet, but to participate in this project to save the Earth. So it was a completely unexpected bonus that by doing good, he was actually able to do well.
See, now that also goes to a misconception that I had when I first picked up your book. And that is, Barry, that I thought you were going to be writing mostly about white-collar workers here and how their lives can be made better so that their job is something that they look forward to every day. But in a carpet factory, we're talking about blue-collar workers who had their lives changed by the way the boss's attitude affected them, right?
Yes, and I did that quite deliberately because I think a lot of people have this attitude that there's us and there's them. Us as the highly educated, white-collar knowledge workers, and we want meaning and significance in the work we do. But everybody else is just a paycheck. And so, you know, when we're organizing a workplace, it doesn't really matter what the work is like since these blue-collar workers don't care. Just make it as efficient as possible and treat them as interchangeable parts. So I deliberately wrote about hospital custodians, supermarket clerks, hairdressers, and these carpet factory workers to show that this notion that there's us and then there's them is just false. The them care about what they do just as much as the us care about what we do.
Yeah, you mentioned the hospital janitors. I really got caught up in a story of a couple of these guys, men and women actually, who see their job as more than just cleaning, that they are actually part of the health regimen of that hospital, right?
And yes, it's quite striking, you know, their job description doesn't even mention another human being. But here are some of them, worrying about cheering up patients, making them laugh, calming one down so that a nurse can put in an IV line, not sweeping the visitor's lounge so that the family members who have been there can nap because they've been there all night, and stuff like that, helping turn patients so that patients don't get bed sores. None of this is in their job description. All of this is extra work. None of this are they compensated for. But their idea is, I'm not a janitor. I'm a hospital janitor. And I have a central role to play in the noble mission of a hospital, which is to cure disease and ease suffering. And if I didn't do my job well, the hospital would fail. Now, you know, I don't know how this happens with some janitors. I do know how you can kill it. If you got a supervisor looking over their shoulders all the time to make sure they're doing their job, all this stuff is going to go away.
Yeah, I would bet that in most workplaces, if you're under close scrutiny all day long, you come to loathe your job much more than somebody who may have a little bit more flexibility because they're not constantly under the gun.
Exactly right. You want to create an atmosphere that shows that you actually trust and respect employees and will let them figure out how to handle whatever problems they face. You know, if you got somebody in a call center and you know that there's a manager making sure that each call you're off in less than 3 minutes or whatever it is, then you're just going to be reading from a script and you're not going to really care whether you're helping solve this person's problem or not. If, however, the mission is solve people's problems, now all of a sudden you try to figure out, what does this person need? How sophisticated is this person? What kind of an explanation is the right one for me to give? And it may take 10 minutes instead of 2 minutes. And you feel, you know, like you're in charge of something and that you're making a difference in somebody's life.
One place that I think is a perfect example of what you're talking about is the Apple store, where the employees, all walking around with all this Apple knowledge in their head, they're enthusiasts about the product, and they will take the time to work with somebody and try to help them figure out what their problem is. Or somebody new comes in and says, hey, how does this Apple TV work? Or what about this new iPhone or whatever it is? And they're so enthusiastic about it that they want to keep you there and tell you everything they can about it, not to the point of annoyance, but until the point where you're satisfied with your experience there. Rather than having somebody over their head cracking down saying, hey, you spent 9 minutes with that lady, you didn't sell her anything, we're not going to make our quota this month.
Exactly so. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the Apple store, because my understanding is that the people who work in the Apple store get paid terribly.
Is that right?
That's not why they're there.
They're there because they're enthusiasts for the product.
They're enthusiasts for the product, and they want to help people who come in solve whatever technological problem they have.
Now, what does this mean when we talk about the extended workday that so many Americans face now, where your job doesn't end when you leave your cubicle and go home at the end of the day because you're always now available via that iPhone we were just talking about? You can get email, your boss can text you, etc. Has that affected Americans' satisfaction with their job?
Well, I think this is a complicated thing. You know, one of the nice things about being really engaged with your work is that you don't leave the work when you leave the workplace. You care about it, so you're thinking about it. And if all you're doing is thinking about it because you can't actually do it unless you're there, then you can imagine that maintaining a work-life balance is not impossible. But if you can work remotely, now all of a sudden people face a different problem, which is, how do I stop myself from working all the time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my profession, a college professor, even before the internet days, you know, I could work round the clock. There's always one more article to read, one more book to read, one more something to do. And the challenge is, I'm very engaged with what I do. So for me, the challenge has always been, how do you stop? So you can pay attention to your spouse and your kids and watch a football game and so on and so forth. I think that's a good problem to have when it's on you to set the limits. When your employer is expecting you to be available 24/7, that's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
But when the problem is you, I think that's an okay problem to have.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. What percentage of people work because they enjoy it or are fulfilled by their work, as opposed to those who look at it as, ugh, the drudgery of another day?
Well, the Gallup organization polls on this question, and the most recent poll I saw, 13% of people are actively engaged with their work. About half of people are unengaged, and the other 35%, whatever it is, are actively disengaged. So roughly 10% of the workforce is eager to show up for work every day.
Yeah, but a third of them are not.
No, a third of them are, you know, would rather be anyplace else, and the rest are just kind of neutral. You know, it's like at least it's a paycheck.
What factor does design play? You know, we hear these stories about Silicon Valley companies like Google that set up a place where it almost seems like it's fun to go to work, where, you know, you can have food anytime you want. You can bring your dry cleaning in. We have that taken care of for you. You know, you can play ping pong for a half hour in the middle of the day if you want to. How much does that go to job satisfaction?
Very little. I have been at Google several times. I've done a little bit of work with their HR people, and all that stuff is there. And every time I'm there, none of it is being used by anybody. You know, in principle, I could be playing ping pong. In principle, I could be playing beach volleyball. I mean, people do use the cafeteria. But even then, they go down there, they fill a tray, and they take the tray back up to their offices and work. The magic of Google is the work. It's not the accoutrements,
mm-hmm.
which is what get all the attention.
Yep.
If you made work, the work that their people do, more like drudgery, the accoutrements wouldn't keep them there.
You know, it's funny because we hear about companies now that are telling their employees, look, you can have as much time off as you want. Or Netflix and Microsoft both recently announced very liberal paternity and maternity leave policies for their male and female employees. You need a year, take a year off. We'll have your job when you come back. But that a lot of people don't take advantage of that because we were told they're worried about their job not being there because somebody else will pass them up. It sounds to me like you're saying, no, they want to be there.
I think, well, look, it's a mixture. There's no question that, especially in the last 10 years or so with, you know, the economy so much more uncertain, people are worried about the security of their jobs, and you're kind of always looking over your shoulder to see whether the person to your left or to your right is working harder than you are. So I think there's a certain amount of real concern that if you were to take advantage of this, it would end up hurting you down the line. And, you know, it might. But I don't think it's only that. I think you get consumed, engaged with a problem, consumed by a problem, and you want to keep working on it until you solve it.
How does the U.S. compare to the rest of the world in job satisfaction?
It's better than many parts of the world. In the U.S., I think the 30% of people are engaged with their work instead of 13. So that's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
But still, 30% isn't 100% or 80%, you know. It's still a minority.
I'd like to finish up, Barry, by going back to something you talked about before about, you know, when your job is too structured, when your supervisors are always looking over your shoulder at what you're doing. And I want to talk about one particular profession and that is teaching,
yeah,
which has changed recently, not necessarily at the college level, which you're at, but I'm talking about elementary, middle school, high school, you know, public school teaching, where standardized testing has really affected what they can and can't do each day in the classroom. Have you seen that in your research?
I have, and the weird thing is it's not really the testing. It's the lack of confidence. You know, it's bad enough that you tell teachers what we care about is that kids do well on these standardized tests. But you could also say you achieve that any way you want. And now you've still got lots and lots of discretion and flexibility in how you teach your kids. But they don't do that. They don't just say we want kids to do well on tests. They also say, and here's the script you should follow day by day, hour by hour, lesson by lesson.
Mm.
Now what you're doing, the slogan for this is you're taking highly skilled work and you're de-skilling it. And this is not a stable situation. The more you do it, the less skilled the teachers will be, and the more likely that the skilled teachers will leave the profession. This isn't what I signed up for. I didn't sign up to work in a factory with working on seven-year-old kids.
Yep.
I signed up to use my creativity, my empathy, and my imagination to figure out the best way to do things, and you're not letting me.
They've got to have the right. They've got to have the right to deviate from what was prescribed so that they can adapt it to the kids in their classroom.
Now, I think it's bad to be driven by standardized tests, but it's even worse if what being driven leads you to do is give every teacher a script to follow.
Very interesting. The book is called Why We Work. Barry Schwartz, a professor of psychology at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, is the author. And thank you so much for taking time to join me today.
Thank you. You asked great questions.
Thank you. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.